Okay, so that's it's just raw power, isn't it? A
Sure.
real piece of history coming alive.
Absolutely. Gives you chills.
It really does. And it's the perfect kickoff for today's deep dive. We're basically climbing into the cockpit with a pretty remarkable pilot, Roger Youngblood.
Yeah, he's got such a unique story. I mean, flying the A1 Skyraider, then the A7 Corsair II, and the A10 Thunderbolt.
You exactly. Three legendary ground attack planes. Not many people can claim that.
And what's so valuable here is getting that firsthand perspective.
Up
You know,
top.
someone who actually lived through the evolution of attack aviation across these, well, very different generations of aircraft.
Right. It's a chance to understand the machines, sure, but also the consistent demands, the core job of close air support seen through his eyes. So for you listening, especially if you like getting up to speed on aviation history and pilot experiences efficiently, this is your brief.
Your inside look.
Yeah. Our mission today is pretty straightforward. Get a real feel for flying these planes, understand the shifts, the advancements between them, and, pin down what really defines that crucial job of supporting the troops on the ground.
Okay, so where do we start? The beginning.
Let's start with the one that really grabbed him first, the Douglas A1 Skyraider.
Ah, the SPAD. The aircraft whose sound alone could start a career path, apparently.
It really could. Roger talks about being at Rees Air Force Base. This is where pilots are learning jets, the T-38.
Right, basic jet training.
And a couple of A1s fly in. He heard them, and that was it. Instantly hooked.
Just the sound.
Just the sound. He said it sounded like a big Harley-Davidson engine with a hopped-up cam. Especially when the engine would load around 1,000 RPM.
That deep rumble when it's working.
Exactly that. He fell in love with the sound, the look. Said it reminded him of Snoopy days, World War II, Korea, that kind of imagery.
It's amazing how powerful a sensory thing like sound can be. It wasn't just metal and mechanics, it was history, a mission.
Yeah, a whole identity. And it created this deep connection even before he flew it.
You can see how that bond formed.
And this wasn't just a passing fancy. He was determined to fly the A1. He actually figured the only way to guarantee it was to volunteer for back-to-back tours in Vietnam.
Wow, really?
Yeah, he specifically asked his squadron commander, "How do I get into the A1?" His class only had one slot, went to someone else.
Ah, tough luck initially.
But an instructor told him, "Look, fly what you're assigned, go to Vietnam, and on your second tour, you'll probably get the A1."
And he actually did it.
That's exactly what he did, planned it out.
That's some serious dedication. Making a huge career move just for one specific aircraft. It wasn't just about flying, it was about flying that plane.
And his first time seeing it up close in Vietnam was at Tan Son Hut, Saigon. He saw the South Vietnamese Air Force flying them.
Okay.
And he even noticed similarities between its engine controls, mixture, prop, throttle, and the C-123K transport he knew. So he was already kind of mentally preparing.
Scoping it out, learning even before touching the controls, building that anticipation.
Definitely. And when he finally did get to fly it, he said it felt like being strapped on.
So trapped on.
Yeah, like a marriage between
Yeah.
him and the single-seat aircraft. Totally wedded to it. He even shared the story about final approach.
Oh, yeah.
A respected A1 pilot told him, "Let her dance. Don't fly straight and predictable on final. Make it harder for gunners on the ground."
Let her dance.
I like that. It suggests this intuitive feel for the plane, right? Working with it, not just controlling it, and thinking tactically, even landing.
Exactly. Trust, interdependence. And he talked about the A1's power, even slow, like 100 knots.
Right.
Immense power.
Right.
And the payload, 15 stations. He said it could carry more than a B-17.
More than a B-17. Seriously.
Yep. And had a bigger engine than a B-29.
Yeah.
All in this single seat, single engine package.
That is kind of mind-blowing. It wasn't about sleek jets. It was brute force, endurance, and just hauling a ton of ordnance. Perfect for its role, really. Close air support and SAR search and rescue. Which brings us to a mission he really remembered. Gunfighter A2 Alpha and Bravo.
Okay, SAR mission. Always intense.
Very. An F-4 Phantom went down in the Mujia Pass, super dangerous area, heavily defended.
Right, a major choke point.
Roger was leading the SAR effort. He talked about the difficulty, just locating the crew, the front seater, LT Cole Blissett, and the back seater. And the radio comms were a challenge.
Yes, SAR is incredibly complex. You've got the rescue birds, the protective cover.
Exactly. The A1s, the Sandies providing cover, the Jolly Green helicopters for the actual pickup. You've got FACs, forward air controllers coordinating.
And fast movers, the jets, to sanitize the area, suppress enemy fire.
Right. He called it an orchestration, like an opera in the sky, all these pieces needing to work together. You'd have a command ship, Kingbird, directing traffic, the FACs clearing the zone, if needed, jets bombing nearby, just to keep the enemy's heads down while the jollies went in.
A huge, coordinated effort under incredible pressure.
And he said the relief, the feeling when the jolly reported feet-wet survivors safely on board was just immense.
I can only imagine. And that camaraderie he mentioned back at the Oak Club after a successful rescue.
Yeah, it really paints a picture. These guys literally putting their lives on the line for each other.
Mm-hmm. And that strange, unwritten rule about the enemy sometimes holding fire during the actual helicopter extraction.
A grim sort of battlefield courtesy, almost. Acknowledging the rescue itself.
Even in the midst of it all.
And the story comes full circle because Roger actually reconnected with Lieutenant Colonel Blissett, the pilot he helped rescue, years later, on Thanksgiving Day, of all days.
Wow. That must have been quite a call. It really drives home the human side of these, you know, military operations. Real people, real danger, lasting connections.
Absolutely. So after the A1, his career moves on, and he hits this huge technological jump when he transitions to the A7 Corsair II.
Right, the computerized weapons delivery. He called that leap cosmic.
He did. A massive change from the A1's more analog setup. But he said he really enjoyed flying the A7 too.
That shift to digital must have been something else. Increased accuracy, different workload for the pilot.
Yeah.
Changing the whole game. Tactically.
Definitely. And then came the A-10 Thunderbolt II, or as Roger put it.
He's just an A-1 with a zero on the end.
Huh. Yeah. He saw those parallels, right? Designed for long loiter times, carrying a lot of ordnance.
Big gun.
Big gun. That core mission was similar.
It's a great shorthand, really. Mm-hmm. Captures the A-10's purpose. Effective CAS, survivability, firepower.
Yeah.
Like the A-1, but, you know, achieved with totally different tech.
The biggest difference being the A-10's fanjet engines, of course. Much more complex aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, his first flight, solo, just like that, after check-in.
Wow, straight into the single-seater.
Yep. And he was immediately impressed by its maneuverability, said it could whip around 180 degrees really fast, like 20 degrees per second.
That agility down low where CAS happens, that's a huge advantage. Lets you re-engage quickly, dodge threats, keep your eyes on the situation.
And then there's the gun. The GAU-8 Avenger.
The BRRRT.
Exactly. Roger said nobody wanted to mess with that 30-millimeter cannon. He talked about red flag exercises.
Realistic combat training.
Right. Where simulated enemy planes trying to get on the A-10's tail would just break off the second the A-10 turned towards them.
I believe it. That gun is legendary for a reason. The sheer firepower, the psychological effect, it's immense.
He stressed how effective it was for troops on the ground, just as a deterrent. They felt safer knowing an A-10 was up there.
Which really underscores the need for dedicated CAS platforms, doesn't it?
It's it.
Even with all the technological change, that fundamental role the A-1 filled is still vital. And the A-10 carries that torch.
So looking back across all three, A-1, A-7, A-10, Roger pointed out some common threads.
Okay.
Operating low, mostly below 5 or 6,000 feet for attack runs. And the absolute need for situational awareness. Especially as a single-seat pilot.
Juggling everything. Flying the plane, managing radios, fuel, weapon systems. It's intense.
Totally. He said his training hammered home those basics. Aviate, navigate, communicate. Control the aircraft, analyze the situation, take action. That core training applied across all three, no matter the tech differences.
That foundation is everything. Those emergency procedures, that constant assessment, it has to be second nature.
He also mentioned cockpit evolution, the A1's layout versus the A10's more ergonomic design.
Putting key controls up high on the eyebrow panel so you don't have to look down as much. Makes sense.
Yeah. And interestingly, he actually worked on the SAR manuals for all three planes as he transitioned.
So even though the aircraft changed dramatically, the basic rescue procedures, the doctrine, had a strong consistency.
Exactly. And throughout it all, his passion just shines through for the planes, the experience. He even remembered the specific smell of the A1's fuel.
Wow, that's a deep sensory memory.
Yeah.
It's not just flying. It's sights, sounds, smells.
Yeah.
It becomes part of who you are.
For sure. And he really values events that bring these planes and the people who flew them back together.
Like that reunion he mentioned.
Yeah. Seeing two specific A1s, tail numbers 665 and 606, together again after 44 years. He'd flown them together in 1975.
No way.
Seeing them side by side, hearing them start up, he said it was beyond belief. Just brought everything rushing back.
That's powerful. A tangible link to the past, to those experiences, those people.
And he hopes these aircraft, these stories will inspire, you know, future generations.
It's important to keep that history alive, preserve the stories, the machines themselves.
So wrapping up this deep dive into Roger Youngblood's incredible career, we've seen the sheer dedication needed for these attack roles, haven't we?
Definitely. And that deep bond between pilot and machine.
We trace the evolution from the raw power of the A-1 to the tech of the A-7 and A-10. And saw how vital those CAS and SAR missions always were.
Missions he was right in the thick of across all three types.
For you listening, looking for that efficient insight, Roger's journey is just, well, it's a unique window into aviation history, isn't it?
Absolutely. His accounts bring it all to life, not just the tech specs, but the human side.
Yeah.
The skill, the risk, the teamwork, the reality of military aviation.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with. Think about how, despite all the incredible technology we've talked about,
it still comes down to the human element.
Exactly. The courage, the skill required then and now to operate these machines in tough situations. It makes you wonder what other stories are out there, you know? Still waiting to be told, offering even more insight into humans and flight.